1971, 3,000 employees dedicated to creating innovative technologies to treat heart disease.
Good morning. Welcome to Mid-Morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer. Well, we've been talking this morning about the impact of legal decisions on the ongoing presidential election. But as we all know, there's also the court of public opinion to consider. What political rulings are in the works in the wake of yesterday's court moves? Are we in the final days of this election? Is it time to talk about concession? We know it's time to talk about politics. And for that this morning, we're turning to Robert Spitzer. He's a professor of political science at the State University of New York at Cortland. He joins us by phone. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning, Catherine. Can you hear me okay?
I sure can. You
very good.
Sound great. Now, let's talk for a minute about, we've talked a lot about the different legal implications and what these rulings mean and where the next appeal is going to come from. Let's talk about what political appeals are left for both candidates here.
Well, by political appeals, I'm not quite sure what you mean. That is continuing to work through the court or trying to curry public opinion?
I'm trying to curry public opinion. Let's start with, of course, Vice President Gore. There are so many folks who are saying this is the beginning of the end for him. How much political rope does he have left?
He has very, very little left. In fact, I think my own view is that basically it's over for Gore. There are still some legal options because the only way the current trends can be altered is through legal action. That is, there's nothing that Gore can do to mobilize public opinion now or political support that will reverse things. The only way that he can gain any kind of ground now is through further legal action. And, of course, his people already indicated yesterday that they had filed briefs with the Florida State Supreme Court to overturn the ruling yesterday of Judge Sandra Sauls. And what we're seeing across the country is that support for Gore continues to be strong, but there is also a slowly rising tide of sense that it's getting close to time to wrap this thing up and simply call a halt to it, regardless of whether the outcome represents necessarily the most just outcome.
Well, what do we know about how long the public is willing to go through this process?
Well, I think that once we get to the two first important deadlines, that is the certification of electors on December 12th and then the date of December 18th when electors actually cast their electoral votes in states, in all of the states around the country, the first date in particular of December 12th I think is very important. And if on December 12th there continued to be a legitimate dispute, a dispute that the law would allow, that the electoral votes of Florida are still in question, I think people would have some tolerance. Certainly the system does not grind to a halt because a single state is having a problem deciding where its electoral votes could go. I mean, there is precedent for that sort of problem, although it's in the 19th century. But as that progresses and as we near, especially the December 18th deadline, I think the pressure for this to be concluded, pressures that help Mr. Bush, I think will make it at this point, given the two court rulings from yesterday, all but inevitable that this will now swing to Bush.
We've been talking most of the morning, it seems, about Vice President Gore and his attorneys and Vice President Gore and his advisors. Let's talk for a minute about the Bush side of the aisle. Vice presidential candidate, I guess we should call him, Dick Cheney, has been making very public calls for Al Gore to resign. What do you make of that? What do you think he was hoping to achieve by doing that?
Well, I think the point of Cheney's rather insistent message, and he's been saying this now for some time, as have many other Republicans, that Gore should simply give it up and that it's over, is really part of the Bush campaign's long-term strategy. That is, even when they were campaigning last year and through the primaries and into the fall race, they were campaigning as confident winners. We know we're going to win this race. This is our race to have. And the same attitude prevailed on election night and into the next day. And almost immediately, the Bush campaign adopted this whole attitude that Bush had won the race, Gore was being an obstructionist, and it was time to move along and for Gore to concede, even though it was very close. And these recent statements by Cheney, I think, are really consistent with that political strategy that really traces back throughout the Bush campaign, going back to early this year and even before.
Well, that's a political strategy to win. What about the political strategy where you want to unify the nation? At what point do Texas Governor George W. Bush and Secretary Cheney have to start pulling back from being competitors and start thinking about how to appeal to those people on the Gore side of the aisle?
Well, they're trying and have been trying, I think, at least Bush himself, to try and adopt a somewhat more moderate tone. When Bush spoke to the nation, I believe it was last week or perhaps a few days before that, he talked explicitly about common ground between himself and the Democrats. He mentioned some unifying themes, and I think you'll be hearing more of that rhetoric now. I don't think in all that the Bush people have handled the, if you will, the post-election campaign as skillfully as they might have. I think they've been somewhat blundering in how they've handled it, but I think the sort of bipartisan tone is essential to help Bush try and establish a kind of a theme of unity and to try and bring people together, not only in the country, but especially in Congress, because he will have to be dealing with that Congress, assuming he is inaugurated as the president on January 20th of 2001.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned the post-election campaign, which it did seem to turn into. As a political scientist, I mean, this is rather unprecedented to have to suddenly, I mean, mentally, I think these candidates were ready to stop campaigning, and then they had to pick up and go on. Talk about the challenges and what we saw in that post-election campaign.
Yeah, it must have been extraordinarily difficult for the workers and the people in both the Bush and the Gore campaign, because, you know, it's as if you're running a marathon, a race that utterly exhausts you, and you just get to the finish line, and somebody says, oh, you've got to log in another 3 miles. And it surely to the exhausted and, you know, the workers who were just sprinting to the finish line, that is to Election Day, it must have been terribly difficult and also psychologically difficult for both sides. So politically a very difficult task, and not like anything I think we've really seen, certainly not in this century. In the post-election period, or the post-election campaign, as it were, I think the Gore people handled it somewhat more skillfully than the Bush people did. I think Gore's presentation of himself was fairly low-key, was fairly conciliatory, and at the same time they were pursuing their vigorous legal challenges, which of course they have every right to do, and which were understandable given, first, how close the results were in Florida, secondly, the fact that Florida did or would or will determine the winner, and third, because of the abnormally large number of disputed ballots. And there's no question that there are a great many disputed ballots in relationship to the razor-thin margin that Bush maintains. So, you know, very difficult. I would give more points politically to how the Gore people handled it, but because Bush was ahead on election night and because his people have been pursuing to a great extent a tactic of running out the clock, knowing that the December deadlines were going to loom large, I think that strategy has helped the Bush people very much.
Let's go to Lori in Maplewood. Lori, welcome to Mid-Morning. Whoops. I think I have to do that first. There we go. Lori in Maplewood, welcome
to
Mid-Morning. Hi.
I'm here.
Yes.
A couple of things. One, I feel that the politicians don't make enough statements that they have faith in the judicial process. They're almost annoyed that this has gone to the judicial process, whereby our laws allow that process, and I feel discouraged that they and the media seem to put a timeline on the decision needs to be made, and this is so annoying, but whereby that's the process, and it's a great opportunity for everyone to examine that process. And the other thing is that public opinion, the polls show, the whole outcome of the Florida election was based on inaccurate polls. And one of the things that I find also dismaying in the media is that polls are never identified. Was that a poll of 100 people taken inside the Beltway? Was that a poll of people on the telephone in California? It's such a broad term, and then it's used as though it's supposed to impress me as to how I feel about things or how I should view the public at large. And I find it distorting that the media doesn't seem to need to identify the source of the poll.
All right. Thanks, Lori.
Well, yeah, Lori makes a number of good points. She talks about the apparent lack of faith in the judicial process, and I think there has been a fair amount of judicial bashing, and ironically, it's been coming, I think, more from the Republican camp than the Democrats, for the obvious reason that they were not interested in seeing these cases go ahead because they were afraid that a recount might tip the balance against Bush and in favor of Gore. But, and I think there was this sort of judicial bashing was unnecessary and uncalled for. I don't think it helped any. And then you have the irony of the fact that it was the Bush campaign that brought the suit that went to the Supreme Court. And so obviously they felt comfortable using the courts in that circumstance. And I don't think the judiciary or judicial branch has been harmed appreciably, although it's a little more difficult to say what might happen in Florida. But I think there has been more sort of nasty judicial anti-courts talk than we needed. As for the timeline kind of imposed by the media, I think basically the media is just picking up on the legal timeline and accepting the assumption that once, you know, the December 12 and the December 18 deadlines come and go, that will pretty much drive the outcome. And I think the media is accurately reflecting the reality of this post-election campaign. As to the polls more generally, certainly there is inaccurate polling, and for my money, I think there's too much polling and a lot of what I would consider junk polling. And we see that especially during the campaign, where every news organization now wants to do its own poll. And I think we do have too many polls, and it's hard to tell those that are more accurate from those that are less accurate. But on the whole, especially in terms of election night, I think the poll in Florida in particular and the polling around the country was generally pretty accurate. And in point of fact, there's good reason to believe, considerable reason to believe, that in fact the exit polls in Florida on election day that initially called Florida for Gore were correct. That is to say that there were indeed about 25,000 more Florida residents who voted for Gore or who thought they voted for Gore than who thought they voted or did vote for Bush. The reason Bush leads in the count is precisely because of this large block of ballots that were not counted or weren't counted by the machines or that weren't counted properly or that were disputed, etc. And there was an article in the Miami Herald, and there's been other analysis too, which has gotten less attention, which supports that idea. So I actually think the exit polls called it right, but because of the vagaries of the electoral system in Florida, Bush may indeed wind up winning that state.
Again, we're talking to Robert Spitzer. He's a professor of political science at the State University of New York at Cortland. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000. We're going to go to Nora in Minneapolis. Nora, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me on. I also heard on the PBS News show last night about the Miami Herald did an in-depth study of all the complaints of the ballots that were waiting to be counted and figured out the numbers. And it also, what your guest just said, came out with the number that approximately there was 24,000 more votes in Florida for Gore than Bush.
You know, I have to interject here. That's not quite the right characterization of that study. They didn't simply look at the votes where people complained they hadn't been counted. They did their own statistical study trying to assume if every vote had been executed perfectly and then counted based on what they already knew.
From those districts, yes.
And I think that's...
I didn't understand the nature of their study, but they
right.
did say it was some in-depth study of those contended
right.
ballots.
Right. So, okay, but now that we've got that characterization straight, Nora, what's your question?
Well, my question is, now after we see what happened, the stance that the public should take about our government and our elections, should it be like, well, Florida was too screwed up to figure out what their actual vote is because it was so close, so that means we just have to accept it and live with it for 4 years because the system doesn't allow us to make the adjustments for their insufficiency of electoral process?
All right. Thanks, Nora.
Well, Nora, the answer is yes. I honestly think that's the bottom line, and it's difficult to sort of accept in a way. I mean, if it's true that Gore outpolled Bush in Florida, and I believe it is, frankly, but yet at the same time, because of rules and procedures, because of glitches in that process, it may indeed result in the other person being the winner. Is that so unusual? Well, it's really not. If you look at elections around the country, state and local races, we often come up with this sort of problem. Now, it's also true that Florida's balloting system is uniquely troubled. In the mid-1980s, Florida's voting system was pretty sternly criticized because of the high number of ballots that it doesn't count and other glitches associated with it. It's not a good system mechanically, and they've known that for a good 15 years. But Florida, like virtually every other state, is not interested or was not interested in putting a lot of money into coming up with a better balloting system because it's just not something that's a high priority item. Obviously, after this election, it becomes a much higher priority item, and perhaps Florida and other states now will really be looking at the methods that they use for voters to cast their votes and how those votes are tabulated. There's no doubt the system is in need of reform.
We're going to go to Charlie in St. Paul. Charlie, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'll start off by saying I'm clearly a Gore supporter, but I would argue that if the legal interpretations to date are correct, then the law of the land is clearly biased against the ideal of democracy. I would argue that if the votes are never counted, even after all the avenues of appeal are exhausted, I don't believe Gore should concede this election.
Now, Charlie, I want to hang on 1 minute. In the previous hour, we were talking about what the word count really means these days. Now, those votes were machine counted, and they weren't picked up by the machines. So
they weren't counted.
All right. There are people who would say that they were counted, but let's turn to the professor.
Well, let me just make a point about the counting issue.
Mm-hmm.
For example, you see in a bank, for example, you have these machines that count dollar bills. And suppose you have $100 bills, and you put them in a machine that counts bills, and you press the button, and the count says there are 98 bills in that stack, and you know that there are 100. That means there are, you would say, probably, that there are $2 bills in that stack that were not counted. Well, they did run through the machine. They were in the stack. Were they counted? Well, I guess you would say no. And I think it's in that respect that people say that ballots were not counted. That is, there were, you know, punch cards.
I was just going to say, I have to tell you, I'm not sure your analogy is as successful as you would wish, because what we're talking about, I mean, maybe it does work. If your dollar bill is torn in half and there's only half of it there, is that a dimpled Chad? I guess my point
right.
is that there are those people who argue that a dimpled Chad is so ambiguous that it shouldn't be counted.
Right. That's not to cover ground you've already covered,
mm-hmm.
but that indeed is part of the question. But that also is a question that state laws have shed some light on, and as has been pointed out, Texas in particular and other states too have laws on their books that allow a fair amount of discretion for counting such ballots if indeed the voter intent can be discerned.
Well,
and of course, that's understandably, that's a vague mandate, but existing law is fairly liberal for states that have that kind of balloting system in terms of how local officials can count those ballots or whether.
Well, of course, there's another interesting question here. As I had noted earlier, we were talking about the legal implications, or trying to, in the first half of the show. But obviously, this is talk for a minute about the tension of having a political election summarily decided in a courtroom, I think.
Well,
some would argue.
Yeah, that's a critical point. I think the subtext of the court decisions, the Supreme Court decision, the decision from Leon County by Judge Sauls, the subtext of that is judges in general, and in specifically in this case as well, do not want to be seen as having decided an election in a court. They do not want to be in that situation. Now, obviously, no matter how courts rule, right, any kind of decision will have an effect on the outcome, will help shape the outcome, whether it's to uphold that which has occurred up until that point or whether it's to reverse it and to call for some new procedures. But the courts are less likely to be viewed as having tinkered with an election or having had an election decided by a court ruling if they uphold the status quo. if they uphold what exists. Now, if Judge Sauls had ruled the opposite yesterday, if he had ruled in favor of every count that the Gore campaign had raised, and this resulted in massive recounting, etc., people would say in the future that this decision was decided by the courts. And that is far likely to be said, given Judge Sanders Saul's decision yesterday. And frankly, I have no evidence to back this up, but I think one of the reasons his ruling was as sweeping and one-sided as it was yesterday was precisely because he was trying to keep the court from being viewed as an institution that in effect has decided the election. And I think the Supreme Court was keenly mindful of that as well. And I think the evidence of that was the fact that it was A, a narrow decision, and B, that it was a unanimous decision.
Well, I'm confused. You think the federal Supreme Court gave a very narrow decision and made the decision it did to avoid looking like it was deciding an election, and at the same time you think a circuit court judge made the converse, a sweeping decision to avoid that as well? How did that sweeping decision avoid looking? I think you could make the argument that it was so sweeping that it did look like he decided the election.
Well, he did. I don't mean to suggest that ruling, you know, is not critical to deciding the outcome of the race. It is. But by making it sweeping, I think it goes a long way towards firmly slamming the door to future judicial action, as has been pointed out by various commentators already.
Mm-hmm.
The sweeping nature of Judge Saul's decision, not only in terms of his findings of fact, but findings of law, make it extraordinarily difficult or unlikely, although possible, that the Florida Supreme Court will overturn him outright. I mean, they may, but it really puts pressure on them to simply uphold the lower court ruling, just as the Supreme Court's ruling in vacating the Florida Supreme Court decision from yesterday also puts pressure, although not in quite as sweeping a way, but pressure on the Florida court to kind of leave things as they are, that is, with Bush having a lead of a few hundred votes and not engaging in a massive recount or, you know, reexamination of ballots.
Let's go to Don in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm puzzled. How is it possible for a sitting vice president to lose his home state of Tennessee as a favorite son, and win the popular vote in a state of Florida where the legislature is heavily Republican and the governor is Republican, and all the states surrounding it, all the South, went for Mr. Bush? Is there something I'm missing here?
Well, a couple things I would say, Don. One is that in the case of Tennessee, in the 1990s, Tennessee has become a more strongly Republican state, just in terms of its electoral composition and its voting patterns. And also, even though it's been pointed out that Gore won, I don't remember the number, eight consecutive elections, I guess, in the state of Tennessee, going back to when he was in the House of Representatives, and including his two vice presidential races in 1992 and 96, when Tennessee went for Clinton and Gore, the two vice presidential races in the 90s were national races. Gore wasn't really spending a lot of time campaigning in his home state of Tennessee. It was more a vote in favor of Clinton, because most people, when they vote for president, vote for the presidential candidate, not the vice presidential candidate. And even though it was a close race, Tennessee was a state that, just because of its changing composition, it went Republican. And as for Florida, Florida is different from other southern states, because it has a great many a large percentage of its population that has come from the north, an increasingly large senior citizen population, again, a great many northerners, people from other parts of the country. Its demographic makeup is quite different from other southern states, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, South Carolina, Louisiana. And so it is indeed a state that can be more heavily, that has a much more democratic proclivity, despite the fact that it has a Republican governor and Republican state legislature.
We're talking to Robert Spitzer. He's a professor of political science at the State University of New York at Cortland. And we'll continue that conversation with him and with you. But first, we're going to turn to Greta Cunningham. I'm Catherine Lanford. You're listening to Mid-Morning. We turn things now over to Greta, because she's standing by with the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom.
That's right, Catherine. Good morning. Attorneys for Al Gore and George W. Bush have a 3 p.m. Eastern Time deadline to file briefs with Florida's Supreme Court. Gore attorneys immediately appealed yesterday's ruling against them by a state judge, A Florida judge rejected Gore's arguments to get thousands of questionable ballots recounted. George W. Bush says he's continuing to work on the transition to a Bush administration. Bush told reporters in Austin, Texas this morning that he thought yesterday's court ruling was a very thorough opinion. Bush said the next step is to see how quickly Florida's higher courts act. Bush isn't calling on Gore to concede the election. He says he can understand what Gore may be going through and that it's been an interesting period of time for both men. Bush says he's in constant contact with transition officials in Washington so that once the election is resolved, his administration will be ready to seize the moment. He's meeting today with his top national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, and Bush also got a national security briefing from a Clinton administration official. Vice presidential candidates Joseph Lieberman and Dick Cheney are both on Capitol Hill today, meeting with lawmakers from their respective parties. House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt told reporters that Democrats are strongly supporting everything that Al Gore is doing in pursuit of Florida's electoral votes. Postal officials have set the date for the upcoming one-cent increase in the cost of sending a letter. A first-class stamp will cost you 34 cents as of January 7th. In regional news, about a quarter of the counties in southwestern Minnesota's 2nd Congressional District have completed their recount. Incumbent David Mingy asked for the recount after losing to Republican challenger Mark Kennedy by 155 votes. The forecast for Minnesota calls for sunny skies and cold conditions statewide. Highs today will only reach the single digits. At this hour, Rochester reports clear skies and 2 below 0, and in the Twin Cities, cloudy skies, a temperature of 2 below. That's a look at the latest news.
Programming is supported in part by the members of Minnesota Public Radio's Leadership Circle. For information, call 1-800-227-11. And today's programming is sponsored in part by Armando and Antonio Lazarus, who appreciate your perfect programs.
Minnesota Public Radio celebrates the gift of words and music for the holidays, and you can join in by sharing your good tidings. Once again this year, we'd like to hear your holiday toast, blessing, or poem, and we just might read yours on the air or post it on our website. Nationally known poets Deborah Keenan and Jim Moore will help us award the prizes, and there's even a special prize for the best kids' entry. Check our website for all the details and send your entry by December 15th to Good Tidings, 45 East 7th Street, St. Paul, 55101, or submit it online at minnesotapublicradio.org.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. Hey, want to take just a second here and remind you that we are part of a book club. It's called Talking Volumes. It's a joint venture between Minnesota Public Radio, the Loft Literary Center, and the Star Tribune. And as part of this book club, we take a book club to the air. On this Monday, December 11th, we'll be gathering at the Fitzgerald Theater. Now, you know where that is. That's where Prairie Home is. Well, think of this as the book club home as well. It will be meeting at 6:45 p.m. So make sure you get there because we'll be doing a live broadcast starting at 7 with author Ellen Gilchrist. We talked to her just a few weeks ago here on Mid-Morning. She is a beloved chronicler of the modern South. And of course, her stories are set everywhere. She's many people's favorite short story author. Now, I bet you've probably read one of her books. If you haven't read the latest one, it's called Collected Stories, that's okay. We'll let you into this book club anyway. It's a great event. It's a great way to share your love of reading, your love of Ellen Gilchrist, for instance. So come by this Monday, December 11th. Get comfy in your seat by 6:45 p.m. and join us for a live broadcast of a book club on the air, Talking Volumes, this Monday, December 11th. We hope to see you there. Also want to remind you that we're continuing this hour's conversation with Robert Spitzer. He's a professor of political science at the State University of New York at Cortland. If you'd like to join this conversation on the political implications of yesterday's legal decisions on the ongoing presidential election, it's 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000. Now, Professor Spitzer, I've been calling it the ongoing presidential election. The vote's been certified in Florida, certainly, but when do we actually know that this thing is over?
Well, there are a couple of ways we may know, or we'll know when it's over. I think the most likely outcome at this point is when the Gore campaign has appealed the Leon County judge ruling to the state Supreme Court. That seems to be their last specific appeal. There is action going on in Seminole County as well involving some absentee ballots, but the Gore campaign is not directly involved in that suit. after we hear from the Florida State Supreme Court, I think, assuming that they either decline to rule or that they issue a ruling that does not go in substantially in Gore's favor, I think it's quite likely that Gore may concede. If that does not occur, and then we extend it to next week, I think the next likely sort of line in the sand is the certification of the electors on December 12th, and that's where the Florida State Legislature may come into play. And they do, by all accounts, it does seem quite clear, they do have authority to designate electors, and of course, if they do that, they will be designating Bush electors, and that could well also be a point at which the towel is thrown in by the other side. So I think those are the two immediate points at which this may come to an end.
How would you rate the support for Al Gore right now? And whose support is more critical, the partisans or the public?
Well, I think support for Gore himself is still quite strong. I mean, in general, polls show that regard for Gore is about as high as it is for Bush, paralleling the very close election results from last month. In terms of kind of political support, I think the state of public opinion right now is really more critical. The partisans continue to line up behind their respective leaders, behind Gore and Bush. But I think the sort of tide of public opinion really is a little more important. And had public opinion shifted more quickly or rapidly towards Bush up until now, it would seem to me more likely that Gore might have thrown in the towel. But since that has not happened, I think that's given some encouragement to the Gore people to proceed with their legal challenge, which, again, is perfectly appropriate and certainly under Florida law allowable. But I think the tide of public opinion is away from Gore's continued challenges, especially after this week.
Let's go to John in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thanks, Catherine. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
And good morning, Professor.
Morning.
I just wanted to kind of take a zoom out of Florida and get a macro sort of vision on the country. Ever since the when the presidential candidates started running their ads and everything, my gut feeling was that we're dealing with two lightweights. They're both not major power brokers, in my opinion, and that message has sort of been very consistent and carried throughout the entire election process, and now dealing with these courts. They both look like two adolescents that are just very angry and whining a lot. And something else I like to comment on is, and it's kind of amusing, watching the news now, when you see Gore step up to any podium or there's ever a camera on Gore, and, God bless him, he's a politician, but why is he smiling all the time? What does he have to smile about right now? I'll take your comments off the air.
Okay, thanks, John.
Well, John's comments, I think, reflect the thinking of many or the feelings of many. A lot of people felt that Gore and Bush, in many respects, were two peas in the pod in the sense that they were not seen as sort of large and commanding figures. Not so surprising, given that they're following up on a presidency of a president elected twice and who, by all accounts, even if you don't like Bill Clinton, certainly a very skilled political figure and a skilled leader. So by comparison, I suppose they do seem like lightweights. They have been struggling, I think, especially in recent weeks to try and avoid appearing to be too petulant, too negative, too kind of adolescent, if you will. In terms of image, they've been trying to be to appear, I think, more statesmanlike, and that's been a key element to their appearances. Yeah, Gore, I noticed too. Gore certainly does seem to be smiling every time he has been at the podium. I kind of took that to be his way of trying to reflect a mood that he was not angry, that he was not deeply resentful, but that he felt that, this is a legitimate part of the process and that he considers it important, but that he's not taking it too seriously. That is, he's prepared, and indeed he made comments on 60 Minutes the other night indicating that, he was prepared psychologically, or the implication was he was prepared psychologically to accept defeat. He, assuming he loses the election, then he loses, but he did outpoll George W. Bush nationwide by over 300,000 votes, and he did better than many, perhaps most pundits thought. And he, in many respects, he's not in a bad political position, especially if he can retain some dignity and not be seen as carrying this out too long and too far.
Let's go to Terry in Stillwater. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thinking long term, I can see the Democrats almost having to battle him with the Republic as a theme in the near future. But I also want to look into a further issue. Is I see a segmentation of the country, almost like the pre-Civil War, where the cultures are becoming completely different. It's not I see it in a long-term basis. I'd love to hear from you on that. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure how if I understand Terry's question. I guess he's talking about the way support split between Bush and Gore. That is, Gore was very strong in the Northeast, strong in the far West.
Well, I think that what he was saying is, and I'm not sure he's necessarily citing geography, as much as he is that there's much talk about a divided country.
Mm.
And I've even seen some commentators talking about we haven't been this, the last time we were more divided than this, we had a civil war.
Yeah. I don't buy into that argument. There is a division in the sense that there's a pretty close split between those who support Gore and those who support Bush. But I don't think it's an angry chasm that separates the two sides. I think we're far from that, as a matter of fact. I think really that there's a high degree of consensus, especially as reflected by the fact that both candidates campaigned in a mad dash to the center. And one of the objections people raised was that Gore and Bush were running very similar campaigns and saying things very similarly or in a very similar way. I think there is division and dissension to the extent that people are unsettled by the fact that the election has not been settled. But frankly, once the election is settled, I think this sort of sense in the country of a close division will not be a major issue. I do think there's going to be a problem of division and partisanship in Washington, D.C., inside the Beltway. And that's going to be a problem, and that's going to have spillover effects to the rest of the country. But I think that's really more in Washington. I don't really think there's a gut-level, deep-seated chasm that's splitting the country now. I just don't think that's the political tenor of things.
Yeah, but won't there be challenges for the Bush and Cheney administration, if you will, to pull together a mandate to actually unify the nation?
Oh, yes. There will be a very strong pressure on Bush and Cheney to do that very thing, precisely because they'll be entering the White House without any kind of real mandate, and because George W. Bush campaigned very explicitly on his ability when he was Texas governor to work across the aisle to maintain a bipartisan spirit to unite Democrats and Republicans. And the test is really going to be on him to see if he can deliver on that promise. And I think it's going to be a very much taller order for him to deliver that in Washington, D.C., in part because of the sharp partisans in his own party, Tom DeLay heading the list, the majority whip in the House of Representatives. And Washington, D.C. is far more diverse and partisan than the state of Texas.
Let's go to Ron in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hello, Catherine. And my question for the professor, I'm trying to be partisan about this, but, you know, they knew that they had problems with the voting machines before this election. And, you know, wouldn't that be something that you should take care of after the election? Wasn't there some responsibility beforehand for Gore to check into that maybe before if they thought it was going to be this close?
Okay. Thanks, Ron.
I know that the Gore campaign did have a sense. There were some reports that indicated that they were concerned about some of those things. And even on election day, on the morning of election day, the Gore campaign began receiving complaints from voters in Florida about problems of various sorts, including the ballot, but other things too. And of course, when you're running a 50-state campaign, pretty tough to coordinate everything. Should more have been done before the election? Obviously, yes, but the main responsibility is to state government. It's not to a single political party to, you know, make sure that balloting is done properly. So, you know, I think it's really the principal responsibility lies with the state elections board and the people who run elections in Florida.
We're talking to Robert Spitzer. He's a professor of political science at the State University of New York at Cortland. He joins us by phone. You can do the same. We're talking about the political implications of yesterday's court rulings. Is it time to talk concession, or is it just time to talk politics? Let us know, 1-800-242-2828 in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Let's go to Cynthia in St. Paul. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hello, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'd like to identify myself as someone who has been an election judge in four or five elections here in Minnesota as a Republican. And I believe firmly in the fact that the outcome should is contained in the ballots and should be read. And I'm calling to object to what I consider a dangerous mischaracterization of these court appeals. I've heard it again and again and read it in the papers and on TV, and I heard it again this morning in your show, that judicial action would result in the court selecting the next president. And in fact, if a judge were to rule, if any court were to rule that those ballots should be counted, it's not a judge making the decision of who's the next president. It's the people who mm-hmm. went to the polls and cast a ballot who would be selecting the next president. And as it stands now, we aren't allowing that process to proceed. In fact, where it stands now, we have not a court selecting the next president, but a partisan secretary of state who basically has decreed with her signature certifying those ballots that who the next president will be. And I just think it's dangerous to keep putting it in those terms, that it upsets the balance of powers if you allow the court to select the next president. And I don't think that's actually what would happen if the process were allowed to proceed.
Well, Cynthia, I think at least our previous guest was making the point that the courts were trying to do anything but decide this election. That was why, and I believe our guest this hour was making that point as well, that they don't want to be seen as doing that and indeed don't want to do that.
Well, I don't think they should be afraid of saying, let's hear what the voters have.
So what you're actually saying is that you would like to see the manual recount of the ballots.
Absolutely. I know that in Minnesota, when ballots are spit out of the machine, you run it through again, and if it still isn't read, you put it in a pile and you manually read it with a team of Republicans and Democrats sitting there and looking at each ballot, hand examining it, and it isn't a part of any kind of special right. It's just automatic.
Okay. Thanks, Cynthia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think Cynthia makes a very good point. I mean, her basic point indeed is that if a judge rules that, look, you have to go ahead with a manual recount, that doesn't mean that the court is deciding an election or that the court is somehow invidious. Somehow it's a bad thing because a court has intruded on a political process. And, I mean, I think that's a fundamentally correct point. I mean, the job of the court is to make sure that procedures are followed properly as per state law and state traditions. But the concern really is, I think, the perception of the court making a decision. And I just think that the political perception of a court, you know, again, if Judge Sanders Sauls had ruled yesterday the opposite of what he ruled, then yes, we've got to go and look at all of these disputed ballots, however many tens of thousands there are. I think the perception would be, the attitude would be, oh, this is now a court deciding an election. And that doesn't mean that's the fact of the matter, but I think that's very much the perception. And of course, that would be a perception promoted by the campaign. That would be whatever campaign would be on the losing end of such a count. But I think her point is right.
Let's go to Alice in Mankato. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, asking your guest, how ironic would it be if the judge in Seminole County, using the process of exclusion, which the Republicans seem to have been exceedingly good at, and throwing out the applications, those thousands of applications for ballots, and using the theory that the Democrats have always preached on the process of inclusion, including all of that. And what do you see as a likelihood of that judge doing just that, throwing those applications out, and would it then be the courts have decided the election?
Well, Alice, indeed, this post-election period is rich with ironies, and you've mentioned more than one. Indeed, it would be, I think, ironic in the case of Seminole County, which is the challenge that is not being brought by the Gore campaign, but there are about 15,000 absentee ballots which presumably favor Bush. There's a motion in a court down there to throw out apparently all of them because among them are so-called contaminated ballots, questions of fraud have been raised because Republican Party workers were allowed to come in and do various numbering and other things so that they could be counted, and the Democrats objected to that. At this point, I mean, obviously a ruling coming out of Seminole County could advantage Gore significantly, but I think the pressure, especially after this, depending on when that might occur, if the state Supreme Court in Florida rules against Gore's appeal at the end of this week, I think the pressure will be very great on the Seminole County people to leave things as they are rather than have a sudden turnabout there that goes to Gore's advantage.
You're a political scientist. I'm assuming that you've been chatting and keeping up with other political scientists. I'm curious, what sort of books do you think we're going to see about a year or so down the road?
Oh, boy, there's going to be a lot of work for people like me. First, a lot more attention on the Electoral College, renewed attention on balloting system and the great diversity, to put a nice term to it, of voting systems around the country. There is great variation. There will also be more political pressure, and this will be written up too, to try and have more uniform and more efficient systems of voting. There will be more writing on the relationship between institutions and laws and how that drives politics, because all of this politicking that's going on now is driven by and large by the fact that we have an electoral college. And you have politics that is driven by these electoral college rules, and so there will be renewed attention on that. And, of course, having a president elected with a minority of the popular vote nationwide for the first time in this century is also a signal event, and there's going to be intense focus on the Bush presidency and whether he will be able to get anything much done in the upcoming year. There'll be a lot to write about and talk about.
Let's go to Thomas in Minneapolis. Hi, Thomas.
Good morning, Ms. Lamfer and Professor Spitzer.
Good morning.
Appreciate your program. My question concerns the legitimacy of the outcome, regardless of who's finally determined as president. How does or how can John Q. Public and Jane Q. Public reconcile the fact that they have a bastard president, if that's not too harsh a term?
Yeah, I think that is our outcome, regardless of who the ultimate winner is, for a variety of reasons you could list for either candidate. It is a problem, but again, it's a problem that the country has faced in the past. I think the best example was the Hayes-Tilden election, which has been now much discussed,
mm-hmm.
where a Hayes election really was a situation of sort of more vote stealing by Hayes than by Tilden, and that's kind of why he won, or his people. And there is a legitimacy question, but at the same time, once the president is inaugurated, once the president moves into the White House and governance begins, I think to a great extent people kind of put the asterisks of the election behind them, and because people want their leaders to govern. They want it very much. And I think the comparison is apt if you look at Clinton in the post-impeachment period, and people wondered how on earth can the government continue to operate after the terrible partisanship of the impeachment period of 1998-99, and the fact is it did continue to operate, and people don't talk much about the impeachment process anymore. People want their leaders to govern, and I think that desire overrides the limitations of that either candidate will bring into office.
Let's go to David in Duluth. David, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Catherine.
Hi.
Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
I'm a supporter of Al Gore, and it's been very interesting to me to watch the great confidence he seems to have, and Dick Gephardt and Daschle also, in their support of Gore through this whole process. And I'm really wondering this. Professor, do you think it's possible that Gore's real strategy in this election is to first of all, I think they're a little frightened.
Quickly, David.
Well, do you think the strategy is to stall, using these court cases to nail down Bush's votes, to make sure they're certified, to make sure they can't be changed, to stall for time in order to get the Seminole County case and the Martin County cases heard?
Okay.
No. I they want to see Seminole County and Martin County go ahead, but I don't think that that the other legal actions they've been taking are to sort of set the stage for those other actions, although obviously they could get a favorable result from Seminole or elsewhere, but I don't think it's quite configured that way, although it might have that effect.
Speaking of time, what should we be looking for over the next few days?
Well, I think two critical moments. One, how does the Florida State Supreme Court handle Gore's appeal of Judge Sandersall's ruling? It's going to be soon, presumably by the end of the week or shortly thereafter. And then secondly, the first important electoral deadline of December 12, and does the Florida State Legislature step in and certify electors on that date on behalf of the Republicans? And I think, frankly, if you're George W. Bush, you do not want this election to go in your favor by having the Florida State Legislature seen as ramming through a partisan-based decision about the electors. It may turn out that way, but I think the Bush people want to avoid that if they can.
Well,
but
in fact,
may occur.
That's sort of interesting that now we're hearing that we're not going to see a special session in Florida.
That's an update I had not heard. My understanding was that the plans had been laid for that, although they were not anxious to do it, but I may have missed the latest development.
Well, they've been laid, but now there's some talk this morning that perhaps they think it's not necessary.
Yeah, that certainly is the case, and I think they don't want to do that unless they feel they have no choice, because it would be preferable to have this resolved, presumably if it's in the Republicans' favor in the courts, or to have Gore concede before December 12 rolls around. And frankly, I think that the way things are looking now, I think it is pretty close to being over for Al Gore.
Let's go to Jennifer quickly in Andover. Jennifer, you have to be snappy.
Okay, I will be. My comment is simply, I voted for George Bush, and my comment is that if they send him to Washington without doing everything they can to count all the votes, I no longer have a say, and neither do you in this country.
All right.
Some people view the results that way, although obviously if you live in Minnesota, you know how Minnesota's electoral votes went. And it's simply such a close election. I mean, you know, many people have said, look, really what we've got is a tie. And in some localities, when you have a tie, you flip a coin to decide who holds office. And we don't do that for the presidency, but we're almost at that point. It's simply a function of the fact that this was such a razor close election.
All right. I want to thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
All right. Robert Spitzer is a professor of political science at the State University of New York at Cortland. I'm Catherine Lanfer. I want to leave you with a final reminder that we'll be having our Talking Volumes Book Club this Monday, December 11th at the Fitzgerald Theater. We'll be entertaining author Ellen Gilchrist. We'd sure like to see you there as well. It's Monday, December 11th. Have to be in your seat by 6:45. And I also need to remind you that if you've missed any mid-morning shows for the last week, you can find them online at minnesotapublicradio.org. Make sure that you click the link for mid-morning.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by members who have made a gift to MPR in the year 2000. If you are considering a special gift this year, call Katie at 651-290-1216 for more information about your options. I'm Lorna Benson on the next